quite on time. It's my very happy task to welcome Rabbi Raymond Apple from the Great Synagogue here in Sydney to our college today. He's the chief rabbi of the synagogue, and so we're privileged to have a distinguished visitor with us. And I do thank you, Rabbi, for making time in your busy schedule to include us. In this college, we all have an interest in what we call the Old Testament and its relationship to the New Testament. But when it comes to the Masorah, I think probably none of us could call ourselves experts, although we all do have an indirect interest in it. And so we're very privileged to have someone who can come and give us the inside story, so to speak, on this today. So the lecture is on the Masorah. I invite you now, Rabbi, to address us.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity of paying another visit to Moore College. The buildings are not quite what they were the last time I was here, and it's quite impressive to see that the conditions under which you studied. I only wish that around the corner at Sydney University in the Semitic Studies Department we had physical facilities even a quarter as good as this, because most of the time we are teaching there in odd nooks and crannies and in places where it's terribly cold in the winter and terribly hot in the summer, and you can't always see to read your notes and so on and so forth. So it's good to see that at least some people enjoy something a little bit better. Okay. I just want to ask, if I may, one preliminary question which will determine to some extent the way in which I tackle today's subject. That question is, how many of you can more or less cope with the Hebrew alphabet? Now, that's very important. Okay. Is there anyone who, to their shame or otherwise, has never learnt the Hebrew alphabet? Fine. Okay. That helps me a great deal. No. The subject that I've been asked to try to introduce to you is one which is very, very fascinating, but in some ways very complex. I am by no means a particular scholar of the Masorah, and it could well be that some of the things that some of you might want to ask are questions which I can't cope with, but let's at least check. One has to begin by saying that the Hebrew Bible is the foundation document of Judaism and, through it, of its daughter religions. H.G. Wells once said that Judaism was a literature-based religion. And here you have the literature. Now, the popular view, which I guess every Jew holds as almost an article of faith, is that when you open particularly the Torah, the five books of Moses, in the printed form in which one can buy it at any bookshop, it's exactly the same as the written form of the Torah in the time of Moses and the children of Israel, and that there has never been a change, that everything is identical, and that this comforting thought is something which is axiomatic. Unfortunately, their popular view, while it is a very pious and a very impressive assertion, is not quite correct. Then there are those who say that the Dead Sea Scrolls are identical with the versions of the books of the Hebrew Bible that we find in the printed version, and that too is certainly far from correct. So our question is, who was it that was responsible for fixing the text and the appearance of the Hebrew Bible as we have it today? I wish I could tell you the names of all the people involved, exactly where they lived and when they lived and when each element of the task was completed. If I could do that, well, then obviously there'd be no need for me to attempt to give you a lecture or anyone else. It's far too complex. Let's then begin by asking, when we say that the fixing of the text and how you handle it is known as masorah, what does that Hebrew word mean? Well, dare I tempt fate and write the word in Hebrew? I could. Okay. Now, according to some, this derives from the Hebrew root masar, which means to hand over. And therefore, masorah means the tradition handed over by one generation to another. There is at least one other popular view, which is that it comes not from that root, but from the root asar with an aleph, which means to bind. In which case, what we are dealing with is that which, as it were, binds us to the text and the text to us. The result is exactly the same, but you've got to be pedantic and look for a root as well as a modern interpretation. The earlier term for the people who created the Masorah in Hebrew, they're known as Ba'alei Masorah, literally the masters of the Masorah. The earlier term was Sofrim, connected, of course, with the Hebrew word Sefer, which means a book. And some say that the word Sofrim, which you find, for example, in the title of Ezra, who's known as Ezra HaSofer, translated into Ezra the Scribe, some say that, in fact, the root of this word is the word Safar, which means to count. Because the Sofrim were the experts who counted every word, every letter, every verse of the Hebrew Bible. Now, when their activity began, we can't pinpoint. Somewhere in the late Second Temple period. More than that, we can't say. We do know that early rabbinic literature, i.e. from more or less the time of the beginning of Christianity, was already concerned with some of the issues which led to the creation of a whole system which eventually became the Masorah. Now, I'm going to show you one or two specific illustrations of where already, nearly 2,000 years ago, they were counting words and letters and fixing a text. So, see how fast you can find Leviticus chapter 11, verse 42. Okay. Leviticus 11, verse 42. Okay. Now, the question I'm going to ask is, can you please quickly just scan through that verse, don't bother to translate it or read it, and find an unusual feature about the way the verse is written? Has anyone found anything yet? Uh-huh. What's unusual about that verse? Thank you very much. Okay. Have a look at verse 42. Kol holech al gachon. You see in the word gachon a very big letter vav? Yep. In the middle of nowhere, a big letter. All right, now we're going to see how good your eyesight is. Go to the very bottom of a page. Under the text, you see in very small print. You see what it says, verse 42? Yep. All right. Now, I don't know how far you're going to go with this Hebrew, but I'll read it for you. It says, Vav Rabati. A big Vav. Vahi Chatsi HaTorah Be'otiot. And this is the middle of the Torah in letters. Already in the early rabbinic period, they counted all the letters of the Torah and discovered that the midpoint was the Vav of Gachon. Right? You see, they had no television, they had no videos. Okay, listen. I wish the people without television and videos would at least play games with the Bible and not with other things. But anyhow. Okay, now. I'm going to show you something else. Would you go now to Deuteronomy 33, verse 27? Deuteronomy 33, 27. Okay. Can somebody please read me the first Hebrew word in verse 27? Me'onah. Right? Now, I wonder who's clever enough to know what the verse says. Me'onah Elohe Kedem means, or is usually translated, a refuge is the eternal God. Me'onah, refuge. Again, in early rabbinic literature, they made the comment that there was a scroll in the temple treasury in the time of the Second Temple which had not Ma'onah with a hey on the end, but Ma'on. It means the same thing. The hey doesn't make it better or worse. So in other words, here you have at a very early period all the particular features of Torah scrolls being studied, investigated, and recorded. You ask the question, why in this, as in other places, there are sometimes variant spellings between one manuscript and another? And the answer is either it was careless copyists, or possibly sectarian or party philosophies that wanted the text to go their way. But so far what we're doing is playing games. It's not really until after the period of the Talmud, i.e. from about the 6th century onwards, that this now becomes a serious subject which occupied generations and generations of scholars as a full-time occupation. Not playing games, but doing a number of things. Number one, studying the reading and writing of the Hebrew text. Number two, organizing divisions and subdivisions in the text. And number three, creating systems of vocalization and cantillation. Now each of these we'll analyze, but let me just repeat the three headings. One, reading and writing of the biblical text. Two, divisions and subdivisions of the text. And three, creating a system of vocalization and cantillation. Well, let's look at each thing. One had to know how to read the text. The fact that Hebrew is full of consonants, but that, until this particular
particular process started, there were no vowels, meant that you could never be certain how to read a Hebrew word.
Right, let's try it. Mem, lamed, ha.
How do you read it? Anyone tell me? Or somebody says, Melech, another one? Malach, another one? Molech, another one? Another one? It could also be Meloch. It could be Maloch. All right, let's see what it is. The root has to do with ruling, yep. Melech is a king. Malach, he rule. Meloch is imperative, rule. Maloch is an imperative, an infinitive, right? And Molech, who is Molech in the Bible? Okay? A nice person or not a nice person? Okay.
Thank you very much. So you are faced with consonants. How do you read them? Which means, therefore, that the first task of the Ba'alei Masorah, the Masoretes, the scholars building up this Masorah, this tradition, was how to read the text. Sometimes they decided that, as written, the text was not as it should be read. So one of their devices was to create what was known as, and again, forgive me if I write the Hebrew words, but you told me to read Hebrew, okay, is a device known as Karib and Ketiv. Karib means to read, Ketiv means it is written. So there's a number of places where the written text is read differently. Okay, well, we're going to give you an illustration. You're now going to go to Deuteronomy 28, verse 27. Deuteronomy 28, verse 27. Okay. This is part of a horrific series of curses which is threatened for disobedience to God's laws. It says, if you look at the Hebrew, Yakecha Adonai Bishchin Mitzrayim, okay, the Lord will smite you with the boils of Egypt, Uva, something or other. Now, can you find the word, the third last word in the line? Do you see over it a little circle? Yep. Right, go right down to the bottom of the page. You see, in small print, it says verse 27. It says, Uvat Chorim, and the Kuf stands for Karim. In other words, whatever the word is in the original text, you don't read it like so. You read it about the Chorim. What are they doing? This is a case where they don't like the word as it's written, because it is a very frightening and obscene word. Whatever particular plague this is that the Torah says God will bring upon you if you disobey him, we don't even want our lips to be sullied by saying it. So the Ketiv is one thing, the Kari is another. And while we're on that page, look at verse 30. Isha ta'ares, ta'aras, the ish achar, acher, yish galena. Last word in the line, yish galena. A little circle over it. Yep. Go to the bottom of the page, verse 30. It says yish kavena kari. It's a very rude word in the Hebrew text. It says, you'll betroth a woman, but a different man will sleep with her. Or at least that's what the bottom of the page says. What it actually says in the text is too rude, and they didn't want it mentioned in the synagogue.
right? Well, these days we don't know any distinctions. We use all the rude words and the pity, but anyhow. Okay, so what do we do? These are just a couple of examples of the device brought in by the Bale Masura, how you read the text. Number one is how you pronounce the words, and number two, how sometimes you replace the written text with a different way of reading it. Okay? Now, there are a number of other things they did. We're going to pick out just a few. Genesis 18, verse 22, please. Okay. Genesis 18, verse 22. Vayithnu mishama anashim. This is in the story of Abraham and the end of Sodom and Gomorrah. Vayithnu mishama anashim. Vayelechu Sodoma. And the men turned aside from there, and they went to Sodom. Ve'avraham odenu omeid lifnei Adonai. And Abraham was still standing before the Lord. Okay. One of the things the Bale Masura did was they changed the original text altogether. Originally, it read, and the Lord was still standing before Abraham. They changed it around. And Abraham was still standing before the Lord because it sounded a little bit disrespectful to God the way it was. So here you've got not just one word replacing another, but a whole sentence being turned around. All right, now, while we're at it, we stay on that page. Can you go to verse 9, the top of the page? Another device of the Masoretes. Verse 9, Vayomru Elav. What do you see over Elav? A lot of little dots, yeah, with a circle. The circle is the sort of the trade secret that tells you to go to the bottom of the page. Verse 9, it says, Nakud al Elav. There are dots on Elav. Now, there are a number of places in the Bible where there are dots over the letters. They are placed there. Some to mark dubious or variant readings, sometimes in order to draw attention to a particular episode or teaching. So we're dealing therefore with the reading and the writing of the text. Okay. Now there are many, many more such devices. For our purposes, I ought now just to draw your attention to two, so we can move on to the next issue. Can you go to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, please? Okay. First word, what's special about it? There's a circle over it, which tells you. Check at the bottom, all right. And if you can't read what it says at the bottom, you're in trouble. But what if you look at the actual text itself, what is special about the word? A big bait. The circle tells you, go to the bottom, verse 1, bait rabati, a big bait. Right? Okay. But hold on. Now you're going to Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1. I mean, I'm having fun. I hope you are. Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1. Okay. First word. What's special? A small aleph. All right. Again. Does it tell you to look at the bottom? All right, verse 1, Aleph Zeira. That's a small Aleph. Okay. You notice, incidentally, that these notes are in Aramaic and not in Hebrew. Okay. All right. Well, listen. Next time you invite me, I'm going to ask you, can you read Aramaic? All right, now. So a further thing they did was that they either noticed or created peculiarities in the text in terms of bigger letters or smaller letters. The reason why the bay to the beginning of Genesis is big is probably because this is the beginning of the whole text. Why this Aleph is small could well be that originally when a scroll was written, they just began at the beginning, kept going, they didn't know any such thing as punctuation or paragraphing or gaps between words. And since Vayikra ends with an Aleph and El, the next word, begins with an Aleph, it could well be that the whole thing just went on and only one Aleph was there. However, with all of these things, the rabbinic sages derived homiletical lessons. They weren't saying that this is the original purpose, but they decided we can preach a sermon. And they said, Vayikra El Moshe means, and he, God, called to Moses. They say when Moses wrote the text of God's dictation, he left out the Aleph at the end of that word because he didn't want anyone to feel that he, Moses, was making a big deal of himself. He didn't want anyone to think, I, Moses, am boasting God spoke to me. So he thought it should better be written Vayikar, without an Aleph, which means, and he happened to Moses. Just by chance that God addressed me, not because he selected me and made me a prophet. And so they're trying to teach the lesson that no one should show off and sort of big note himself. Well, this isn't probably anything near the original reason, but when the Baalei Masorah worked things out, if in the original text there's no Aleph at the end of the word, they thought it really should have been there, so they put it in as a small Aleph, which drew your attention to the fact that there was something different. Now, there are many, many more such things that we could talk about. We could mention, for example, cases where a word is written in a fuller or a less full way. For example, in Genesis chapter 23, you meet an unsavory gentleman called Ephron, whose name is sometimes spelt with a vav and sometimes without. And the rabbinic interpretation of why it's left out is also nice homiletics. It is because Ephron was not a very sincere sort of person, and so there was something missing in his character, as there's something missing in... Okay. It is fun being a rabbi, isn't it? Gosh, am I telling you guys that you should become rabbis, heavens? That's not why you came here, was it? Okay. There are certain letters which are suspended over the line. There are times when there are gaps in the text and so on. All right, so this is the first of the tasks of the Baalei Masorah, to fix the reading and the writing of the text. Number two, to create divisions and subdivisions in the text. As we've seen originally, it was just written continuously. That meant, therefore, presumably, there are no such things as chapters or paragraphs. You just kept going. Well, what the Baalei Masorah did is not the same as the chapters in modern Bibles. You may be interested to know that in Hebrew Bibles, or let me say in Jewish versions of the Hebrew Bible, up until the 14th century, there was no such thing as chapters. You would never say Genesis chapter 1 verse 2, Genesis chapter 3 verse 4. Never heard of it. What they did was they had a different type of subdivision, which we'll describe. But at that stage, it became necessary for Jews, more or less, to adopt the Christian subdivision into chapters, because that was a period in history when the relationship between Jews and Christians was very unpleasant, and frequently there were public disputations between representative Jews and representative Christians. They were disputing publicly the meaning of biblical texts, and so they needed to face the same agenda. So if one referred to Genesis chapter 1, everybody knew, both Jew and Christian, what you were referring to. So chapters came into Jewish literature only at that point. And for some, in some cases, we suspect that there were ideological reasons why Christian chapters ended at a certain place where Jews wouldn't have done it like that. So, just for a moment, let me point out two such cases. Would you go to Genesis chapter 2, verse 1, please? That section which you have in front of you is the seventh day of creation, where after creating one thing after another for 6 days, God then brought the Sabbath into being. Now, this little paragraph about the Sabbath doesn't really belong as part of a new chapter. It should be the ending of the previous chapter, which, as far as Jews are concerned, is the logical way of doing it. It could be, as some say, that Christian Bibles made this chapter 2 because by that stage the notion of the Lord's Day being Sunday had, as it were, overtaken the Jewish idea of the seventh day Sabbath, and therefore they wanted the two things to be separated. That's what some say. And likewise, if you go quickly to chapter 3, where you get the reference to the serpent being more, in inverted commas, clever than all the other beasts, and so on and so forth, and at least the whole story of Adam and Eve and the so-called fall of man. Judaism doesn't make such a big deal out of the sin of Adam and Eve. It doesn't have a normative notion of fall of man or original sin. It wouldn't have put in a division here. He would have said this is just still part of the whole story of Adam and Eve. Which means, therefore, that Judaism is not always completely comfortable with Christian chapters. But that's another story. But let's get back to the subject. What the Bali Masora introduced was a set of divisions where Sidra comes from a root which means order or arrangement. Parasha means something like a portion or a paragraph. The Sidra was the name of the weekly Torah reading. Now, we're going to show you how this works. We've looked at the beginning of Genesis, so we'll continue with that book. Right. Can you please have a look at Genesis chapter 6, verse 9? Above it, you see a heading, two Hebrew letters. Can anyone work them out? Nun Chet. All right. Go to verse 9 and see there you've got the vowels. Ele Toldot. Somebody read it? Noach. Who's Noach? Noah, the flood and the ark and the whole business. Okay? Now, why do you have a heading Noach? This is the beginning of a sidra. The first sidra is called Bereshit. So the reading for that particular week is from Genesis chapter 1 verse 1 to Genesis chapter 6 verse 8. The following week, the sidra is called Noach, right? And so on and so forth. There are 54 such divisions, except that, just to make it complicated, there were two different traditions in ancient Judaism. In one particular tradition, they finished the whole of the five books of Moses in 12 months. So for that they had 54 sidras. You want to know how 54 sidras fit into 52 weeks? Okay. What they did was, from time to time, they doubled up and read two. But, perfectly logical. Okay. But there was also a triennial cycle. So in some traditions, they took 3 years over the reading of the Torah. And so, according to one particular enumeration, they had 154 sidras, according to another 175, according to another 167. So 154, 175, 167. The triennial cycle was eventually discarded, so that everywhere they follow now the annual cycle. So that's a sidra. Now, the parasha is the paragraph. Some paragraphs have a bigger division between them and the next. Others have a smaller. Go. All right. No, we'll stay where we are. Chapter 6, right? The end of verse 12. Can you see a Hebrew letter? The letter Samach. Samach. All right.
This is all adding the knowledge of Hebrew words. It's a Sukumah,
literally closed, because the gap between that paragraph and the next is sort of a closed-in, narrow gap. On the other hand, go up to the top of the page, after verse 8, what do you get? Pay.
Right. So this stands for Petuha, which means open.
In other words, depending on how they worked out the way the paragraphs should be, some had a much more open space after them, others a narrower space. Okay, so what we've got now is two tasks of the Bali Masora. One, the reading and writing of the text. Secondly, is the question of the divisions and subdivisions of the text. We come now to the third of their tasks, which is creation of a system of vocalization and cantillation. Vocalization means putting in the dots and dashes, so you don't just phase consonants, but you have these little vowels which tell you, just in case you didn't know otherwise, how to pronounce the words. Okay. Now, when the system as we now have it came into being is again not entirely certain. We know that by the middle of the 7th century that was more or less completed. So it means that over some generations, maybe a few centuries, they were working on creating a system of dots and dashes. Usually under the Hebrew letters, but occasionally in the middle or on top. Just to make it complicated, because nothing in life is that easy, there were in fact two systems of vocalization. There was the Babylonian and the Palestinian. The Babylonian system had the dots above the letters. The Palestinian, otherwise known as the Tiberian, because it was developed around Tiberius, had the vowels mostly beneath the letters. Well, the Babylonian system was discarded, the Palestinian system became authoritative, so what today we're using is the Palestinian system. Fine. The last thing that I want to say concerning the three tasks of the Bali Masura is the creation of a system of cantillation. Not just how did you read the letters, but how did you chant them? Because the scriptures were, and still are, chanted in the synagogue, and so you need to know what the musical notes are. Well, all right, which page have you got open? Genesis 6, we'll stay there. Okay. We'll go to the beginning of the Sidra Noach, verse 9. First word is? Eleh. Under the Aleph, what do you got? You've got some sort of accent. Look at the next word, tall dot, under the Dalet. Some sort of accent. Under Noach, not under, over the Nun of Noach, right? So, somewhere along the line,
they created a system. Now, just to make it easier for myself, let's say these boxes represent words, right?
So, the system has quite a number of these notes, so I'm not going to go through them all, but now they generally, not always, but they generally sort of follow a pattern like that, which means they come in twos. Depending on which text you're reading and which Jewish community you derive your tradition from, there'll be a particular melody that's used. On a Sabbath in a synagogue, there are two readings, one from the five books of Moses and one from usually the historical prophetical books. The notes are, or the cantillation, or sometimes called the Torah. It all looks the same, but you've got to know that if you're reading from the Torah, you do it one way. If you're reading from the second reading, the Haftarah, you do it another way. And then, if it happens to be the New Year or the Day of Atonement, you do it yet another way, because there you've got to make it seem more solemn. And it's very, very interesting. Now, all right. Let's show you. Let's go to Genesis chapter 1. Whatever talents I have, they don't include the capacity to sing. I warn you. Okay, you see the musical notes under the Shin of Bereshit? Yes? Okay, so the first verse or two would go like this. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz ve'ha-aretz ha-ita tohu va-bohu ve'choshech al pnei tehom ve'ruach Elohim merachefet al pnei ha-mayim, etc. Right? Now, I don't know how to sing. If I face just a text in the Torah, without any of these things, I wouldn't have the faintest idea. So if I have to chant this from the Torah, I have to prepare it first using a book like this, and that tells me. Now, whether the chants as we have them these days are the same as were already in use in the time of the Second Temple, we can't be certain. There could be some connection. So, let's now sum up where we've got. over a period of several centuries, from about the 6th to the 9th century, a great deal of work was done by people who were concerned with the reading and writing of the text, with the divisions and subdivisions, and with the vowels and cantillation. So that the Hebrew Bible as we have it today owes a great deal not only to the original authors, but to the scholars who made it user-friendly. Now, how do we know what the Baalei Masorah had to say about the text? Where do we get the information as to the instructions and the rubrics which they formulated? By playing the games we've played this afternoon, you've already got the beginning of an answer. Very frequently you get their little notes at the foot of the page, which will explain to you something on the title page, which you might now like to look at. Sefer Torah Nevi'im Uktuvim, the book of the Torah, the prophets and the writings. Meduyak Heitev, carefully edited, al pi, according to, can you read the next word? Try. I know there's no vowels. Ham Masorah, right? So in other words, what you've got here is Masoretic notes. Well, this isn't by any means the only source of Masoretic information. There are a number of very solid collections of Masoretic notes and commentaries. The first of any importance was brought together in the 16th century by an Italian scholar, Elijah Levita, L-E-V-I-T-A, whose book is called Masoret HaMasoret. The play on words, literally, the tradition of the tradition. Then there is the well-known work of Christian Ginzburg in the 19th century, which I'm sure is available in the library here. Printed Bibles like this one contain only the tip of the iceberg, bounded by notes and commentaries and super commentaries. You'll discover that there are two types of Masoretic notes, more or less in every page. There's what's known in Latin as the Masora Parva, which means, anyone know any Latin? Parva, the small Masora, in Hebrew, Masora Katana, and then obviously there's a Masora Magna, the big Masora. So, the Masora Parva, in the outside margin of a rabbinic Bible, indicates words that have peculiar features, such as kari or kativ, or strange spelling. The Masora Magna, which you find sometimes above, sometimes below, sometimes in the inner margin of the text, gives you an expansion of the Masora Parva with a number of additions, such as, for example, where there is something to be noted, the Masora Magna will tell you not only what you should note, but also the number of times that particular feature occurs in the Bible. And therefore, if you're the teacher, you can really show off to your students. Because when you reach a special feature of the text, you can tell your students, now, you know what? You find this 15 times in the whole Bible. And they'll think that you're brilliant. But of course, you know the trade secrets. All right. Now, you'll also find in a rabbinic Bible, at the end of each book of the particular, of the Bible, the Masora Finalis. In fact, in this edition, you've already got some of its information. So we might just very quickly, to conclude this journey, have a look at the end of Genesis.
page 84. Okay? I can't resist the temptation. Have a look at verse 23, what do you see? A big mem. You see the little note at the bottom, verse 23, mem rabati? Big mem. You see, all the secrets you pull into, it's amazing. At the end of the text, you see in Hebrew, the big Hebrew is chazak, yeah, which means be strong. The tradition is when one reaches the end of the reading of a biblical book in the synagogue, we say together, chazak, chazak, benit chazek, be strong, let us strengthen each other. Now we have the strength to continue and open the next book, etc. But now, this is Masora Finalis, underneath. Sikum Psukei de Sefer Bereshit. The sum of the verses in the book of Bereshit, of Genesis, Elef v'chamesh me'ot v'shloshim v'arba'ah, are 1,534. See, they counted, and you see two sets of letters, Ach, Aleph, Chav, Lamed, Dalet, Siman. So, the sign of the number of verses is that if you take those letters, Aleph, Chav, and Lamed, and Dalet, each Hebrew letter has a numerical value. That adds up to whatever we want. Okay? Goes on, V'chetzio, V'al Charbacha Techye. The halfway point is the verse, V'al Charbacha Techye, and by your sword you shall live. Or Parshiotav, the number of sedras is Yod Beit, 12. A hint of the 12 is Ze, Shmi Le'olam. Ze, this is my name forever. Zayin is 7 and Hey is 5. Okay. Usa Darav, and the paragraphs are Mem Gimel 43, etc., etc. Right? So, you've all got your work cut out playing games with the Bible. Right. I want to conclude by telling you, when I think of the whole task of the Bali Masorah, I'm convinced, as I hope you are by now, that this was an absolutely breathtaking achievement. It showed mastery of the whole of biblical literature. It showed the capacity to record and create the apparatus to make the text accessible and usable. And it meant that because of their work, the Bible will be an open book and not a closed book, enabling the whole of mankind to benefit from biblical teaching, values, and inspiration. So, presenting this material to you, I've enjoyed. I hope you've enjoyed playing the games with me. I think we have a few minutes. If anyone would like to ask any questions, it's over to you. Definitely. Because what they do is that they show you the way in which the syllables work. Right? So, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning God created et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz, the heavens and the earth. Right? Ve-ha-aretz hayta tohu, and the earth was empty and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Right? You need another lesson for that. Somebody else? Okay. What I'd like you to do, though, if I may, is now, every time you look at the Hebrew Bible, just remember that a lot of the secrets which you didn't even know were there have now been unlocked to you, and when therefore you pursue your studies in the Hebrew Bible and in all that has come out of it, I hope that all this is going to help you, and the understanding that I think we've been able to share today will be something very useful. So thank you for giving me the opportunity of unlocking the secrets.
Thank you very much.
very kind of you to pity our weakness and speak in a way that we could understand. The fact that there were so few questions was no indication of lack of interest. Actually, we were very frightened that you were going to point us and ask questions. Ask us to read around the class, so we came in fear and trepidation. But we're very, very grateful indeed for a lecture that's most interesting and that we were able to follow and benefit from. I do want to say thank you to Wendy Kapin also, who actually took the initiative to invite Rabbi Apple to come and speak to us. So let's say thank you to Wendy as well. For well, thank you very much for coming. It's great to see such a good roll-up, and I hope there might be more such occasions that we'll have interesting visitors who can help us in areas like this where we need some assistance from those perhaps closer to the area that we're studying than we are ourselves. So let's just thank Rabbi Apple once